Jim came up to me a couple months ago and really wanted to be able to read some stuff here, and we're glad that we're able to make this happen. I didn't know if it was going to, because there's so many things going on here. And get on the blast and you'll find out. Jim Seavey's a Cape Ann native. He's been writing poetry since the mid-60s, publishing occasionally, including in Living Proof by North Shore Writers Workshop. He will read from Work Days, written during the time he lived in Lanesville and worked in downtown Gloucester, each poem being the revelation of the landscape as envisioned by a Cape Ann artist and a selection of other poems. He has been inspired by the great Cape Ann poets, Eliot, Olson, and Farini. He lives in Gloucester and Nashville with his wife of many years, Gail Seavey. Jim.
Thank you, Henry. Okay, I got, you know, I went to art school, so we got to start off with the art stuff and some logistical things here first. I have a friend that was at the last reading I did at the meeting house, and he said, could you make up a packet of poems ahead of time because I'm hard of hearing? So if anybody is hardly hearing, I have a couple of these, and I'll sell them later if you think they're any good. But if you want to look along, if that, and you don't have to be hardly hearing, you can just want to see them.
Yeah,
good. What would you say? Thanks. Okay, then, the first, I think, five or six poems have pictures from Work Days, my book, which you can buy later. It's kind of pre-published state right now. But I have eight copies of page 3, which is all of the paintings that get referred to in the book, and these first five, six poems. So, I got to get art teacher. So I'm going to pass this eight copies. Thank you for being more than eight people. And you can kind of hand them around. I'll do the teacher thing and hand them in two directions and can kind of share. And I'm going to wave to the people right in front. I'm going to wave this around, so you might not need to. All right. Henry asked Sage and I if we would like to write an occasional poem for the day's event or the last night's event, and neither of us could come up with anything decent. But I did, or even indecent, which is now the norm, I guess. But I did want to say that I was talking with Gail, who always does half my thinking, and she said that I had told about the time Vincent, we were all at Galen Gibson's funeral after he had been shot, and Vincent stood up and said, "My words were taken." And I think in terms of writing an occasional piece for the election, that's where we stand right now. We're just is too much and too little to say. Anyway, so jumping right in then, I will read some poems I wrote 30 years ago, and there's not anything political about them. Okay, this is Stuart Davis, and all of these poems are about getting from Lanesville to Bomco.
Bomco.
Oh, they don't need a butterick. Come on. No, that's all right. Yeah. It's on the second rotary. Okay. Workday for Jean Bear O'Gorman. Red maple blooms catch dawnlight out my kitchen window, propelling me through my morning moves. Out the door, some other flash of color jumps my fancy, keeps me dancing through the gray day on a jagged hop, Stuart Davis style across these Cape Ann rocks. Jumping a jazz step around the mills through the rotary, where sunlight sliding low under clouds at a clear over the ocean, nails gulls orange against the slate sky. to down along the docks where rigging frames it all, black lines lurching at the as the inner harbor glows, glowers, diesels fire up, stinging the air. Okay. Nell Blaine. Bus hop for Mike and Ann Lafferty. Poppies splash the green of lawn this morning as I run down the stairs to catch the bus. A breeze tickles the fringe of each petal, sending moire jolts of green-pink through the chill air, the sideways slant of sunlight and reflected glow of dandelion hordes. Promise June day proper. Across the Cape, this light bounces into Nell Blaine's studio, where, with poppy petal brushes, she sweeps it onto a taut weave of canvas whence, bottled on some penthouse wall, dandelion wine will do battle with midwinter smog. Aren't you glad these go fast? That's why I like to write poetry. It's done quick. I'm not into epic. Okay. I'll get one. I'll get a couple that are too long in here. All right. This one here, you'll all, you know, everybody here is up in age, you'll know, or if you're from here. But I did make a mistake writing the poem. I referred to a certain piece of music as a partita. And I thank goodness for the internet, looked it up, and it is, in fact, a concerto for two pianos in C. But I did get the composer correct. this is William Meyerowitz, Friday's Pilgrim, for Erica Funkhauser. Your morning pro musica host, Robert J. Lertzema, WGBH, Boston. Lurchum as birds chirp at the Anisquam Church, as I lose my line through the curves, downshifting, buckled in, not fighting speed, but potholes. Lurchum as birds on another day, the curves on any other day, it could be any other day, Friday. Fridays always segue into Box Patita, the one at the start of Slaughterhouse Five, with Billy Pilgrim lost in the snow, depending upon what Friday. There's always pilgrim snow after the birds, Fridays. The line changes as the potholes change. The light on the church changes with the season. The clouds, sometimes the car windows are down and the birds outside join with the radio birds, or I'm late or early. The whole thing hangs together in space, canvas by Meyerowitz, loose, fragmented, rhythmic, pulsing, timeless, immediate, shaggy whole. Oh, so, when I wrote this poem all these years ago, and I wrote these at work, I was the highest paid poet in the United States of America. I'd go into the men's room and write, and the supervisor would come by and say, "Stevie, what are you doing in there?" And I'd say, "You don't want to know." So, anyway, when I wrote this poem, this painting was by Fitzhugh Lane, who is now FitzHenry Lane, and the painting is by Mary Blood Mellon. So it's the poem that I was thinking of when I wrote the painting, what I was thinking of when I wrote the poem. So here goes. Still waters, waiting wives, for Peter Davison. Against the sepia sunrise, freckles of pink and ochre, they stand in summer dresses. Lane's Cove to braces, Fitzhugh's stillness blesses, the ocean stands a mirror. No wind will stir their tresses, no brush will still the storm. The granite stands, new days are born. Oh, last but not least. Joy, who did this painting? That's Joy Buell. She did. And if you've ever been to her living room, you've seen this beautiful big painting, and it's called, I didn't quite get the official title, but I'm calling it Olson's Poem. Olson Poem.
Yeah, it's Ode to Olson.
Yeah, Ode to Olson, okay. There's nothing about Olson in the poem. But there is about Joy's painting. Occupational hazards for Toy Derricott. Houses waken from the dark as I drive by on the way to work. Lights bathe walls and windows, honey warm, and I look in. Morning, sleep, curled next to my mate, already longing to return. I'm ashamed of how intensely I am peering into other people's houses. Once caught a glimpse of a bare shoulder, back, gasp of breath in an upstairs room. Now I drive a different route. Mostly. Still, I feel a touch, intimate and ghostly. Buell's paintings hover at the truth of this, and I look straight ahead, moving on, afraid, to the male smell and crash of machines, far safer than insinuating dreams. Okay, no more artwork. It's all in the head now. I got little notes of what I was going to say when this was the first thing I was going to read, and I'm not going to say anything. I've already made my Butterick joke. We're done. Olaf Cleary's Eye. No, I do want to say something about this. I want to say that No Smoke influenced me deeply, and the guys I worked with were all... Oh, Trump supporters, but they were all cool guys. They were fun to work with. Even the ones that were idiotic about their politics had a real life to them. And I think that's the cut we need to cross. Olaf Cleary's Eye. When Olaf Cleary lost his eyeball down the sink, he cried, the tears filling up the empty socket. Sloshing out when he leaned over, opening the closed lids like broken waters, staining the cardboard cartons as he packed them at his front door. His wife kissed him, but his daughters wouldn't look. His sons stayed away. They knew, they reminded him of the days he could see with both, when he was a handsome young fellow like them, with girls always hanging around. The guys at work teased him, saying, when they washed their hands, I feel watched. Or, Ollie, how far did it travel before it stopped? When they sat on the pot reading the Herald. A new eye cost $1,200. For that, except for insurance, we might have taken the plumbing apart, followed Ollie's eye to the netherworld, where perfection is always recognized as false. Gypsy Davy. With his blowtorch, he tramps his uncle's fantastic collection of stamps from Dillon. But Gypsy Davy was a welder. Davy was a welder. The arc crackles sunlight to puddle metal in dead air. The rays reach gaps in cloth and glass to excite that action on your skin which deadens us with fear. Drug companies, cults, religions, medical professionals make a business of death, you've said. The splotches there, the corrosion on your ear, signal us to make a business of life for our short time in the sun. He's under my arm. They'll get soggy, but that's okay. I can still read them. All right. Bomko was pretty upset with me when I took off to California for a year, but they let me come back. So the next three are California folks. And this story is pretty clear. In this one, I have to explain a technical term. Oh, first I have to apologize for the presidential term in here. You'll find it when you see it, when you hear it, but it's in quotes. And then, the word tenths refers to 1/10th of an inch. So when I hold my fingers up like this and you can't see quite between them, that's 1/1000th of an inch. And when I squeeze them together, the molecules of air are 1/10,000th of an inch. It's a very, very small dimension. So you have to have specialized equipment to measure it. We'll get to that later, too. Hard Times, Three California Snapshots. Butch. A shotgun load of salt in your hindside stings fierce, you tell us, and you've got to soak it out in the tub, which hurts worse, and you can't tell your folks because they'll want to know what you were doing to be on the receiving end of that farmer's blast, and you're not about to tell them what you tell us now. Good pussy, it was worth it. Now you've ditched your wife and kids in Phoenix and are here in California being driven by a slinky young thing in a sports car. Because you've drunk away your license. You smartly hold tents on the surface grinders and crawl in on time Monday morning on uppers, still trying to get away from West Virginia and the sting of salt. He was a piece of work. John. Oh, yeah, another machine to explain. Coordinate measuring machine. That's how you find out if something is a tenth of a thousandth of an inch off. And it's a big, elaborate gantry with a little tiny sapphire probe that when you touch it, it records the measurement in a three-dimensional, and you need a computer and all kinds of stuff. And it's cool. And they finally got one at Bomco after I came back and said, you got to get one of these things. So, John. Back east, torn open, on the leg, the arms, the chest, and neck by a neighbor's chained dog. The papers you deliver scattered, red with your own life. They put you back together and put away the dog. You've been in the West since you could scram Maryland, started here as a truck driver, surviving the boss's many Monday morning purges, and today show your scars while flying over the keyboard at the processor on the coordinate measuring machine, as sure of the geometric points as you are of the length of taut chain. Charlie was my favorite guy in those out there in California. Charlie, your old man died young of black lung in the 50s, and you quit the mines to scurry here to the West Coast, turning yourself into a machinist of sorts, a dabbler and a doer with a dream schemer's knack for jury-rigged fixes. Soon you will retire to whatever satisfaction oranges and tangerines and lemons can give, growing in your backyard, and you'll smile. That quick, wide smile under a shock of white hair your father never had as you smoke your last cigarette. Okay, now I'm going to get all weird and philosophical, sorry. Yesterday, Gail and I were walking in Good Harbor, and the waves were coming around Salt Island, you know the way they do, and they come from this side, and they come from that side, and they get in the middle, and they go poof, and they make all kinds of fun shapes and so forth. I spent a lot of time taking pictures. That's another job of mine. And those of you who were brought up under a certain cloud will recognize certain phrases from T.S. Eliot in this poem. I'm so sorry. I was struggling. There's a word that Eliot didn't use, which is multiplexed. It has nothing to do with theaters. It's a technique for getting an FM radio signal to deliver stereo sound. Mm-hmm. It's a coding kind of thing, I think. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about codes or anything when I wrote this. A little bit, maybe, about electronics and stuff, but not much. I'm a dabbler and a doer, too. Gap Head. Oh, yeah, I could tell you. I grew up in Rockport and used to walk down the street to Gap Head, which is between... Gap Head is the rock headland above the gap, which is between... separates Straitsmith Island. So, Gap Head. Oh, I did my Butterick moment there. Aren't you cute? Gap Head on high ground... another thing I have to say about this is yesterday or the day before, it was reported in the Times that a guy lost his life at Rafe's Chasm fishing on the rocks. So it's happened before. Gap Head, high on granite ground, an iron cross set firm marks the spot where once a mighty wave washed off, spectators astonished at the storm. at dead low at equinox, Stray Smith Island isthmuses to land by a thin thread of weedy pobbles and of sand, letting children visit where they dared not swim, feared death by drowning. Beyond the isle, spied in all but somber weather, lies the reefs of rock which breach the tide with many hulks below. The headlands at the gap stand high. Climb down the face on toehold, scramble round worn rocks, search high tide underwater caves, barnacled and dripping at the low funnel of the sky-high geyser, etched by the passing wave years in stone. Climb down and gaze at the movement of the waves, each nuanced dance a telegraph of forces far away. Underneath, ground swells undulate the biggest waves, and under all, the tide. The message hits the seaward end of Strait Smith Isle and runs along each side where variations in the shore resound, repeat, reintegrate the pulsing of the waves, until crests cross at the shallows of the gap and recognize each other for the first time. The ineffable sway of the shore and impetus of other rhymes creates a message multiplexed so many times its code exceeds the grasp of mind. The waves of universe wash our poor rocks, crude, hard, and dumb. We try to stand the wash and constant rhythm of erosion, but lose by gradual attrition the sharpness of our form until, save for moving at different speeds, the wave and rock are one. That's before that story. Yeah. There'll be a footnote on that. I wrote this poem when I decided not to be a poet, get into the Poe biz. It was a week-long workshop at the Frost Place. But this is what came of it. En route from Chichen Itza. Old roads seem the same, no matter the ground or vegetation growing over, with dried ruts and rusting junk in random spots alongside. We push ahead to flee mosquitoes, with this trip with no jungle ruin at the end. We talk about our children, your parents, their 40 years and his need to be believed, hers to be understood. You walk ahead, or I, or side by side, met here in the middle of a rare week apart. There is a slight dampness to our skin, like a memory of lovemaking, in this oppressive air, unusual in these New Hampshire hills. We duck under a fallen tree, walk on to find, on the uphill side, a sunken well, worn down through glacial fragments, like the sandstone wells of Chichen Itza, we agree, less likely to have human skeletons below. Though here, it's hard to tell what deeds long winter hides, or what spring demands. Today, there's no rhyme on the mountains, invisible in the mist. On the back porch of the guest house, munching fruit and cheese, chatting with passers, we hang on the edge of the world, nothing to exhume. Yeah. Small solace. Oh, I was so miserable when I wrote this poem. Okay. Gail was in divinity school. Let's see. Now I have to. And Lent here is not about the season. It's about the act of sacrifice. Otherwise, the poem doesn't work right because it's all these references to getting colder, not warmer. So, small solace. Divinity school lament. Spouse at first semester. Frost bites down hard on the ground. Now even the warm sponginess of earth around the overburdened septic sump, oh, I hated that thing, in my backyard clicks underfoot. Once again, the solstice moontide has made an island of Good Harbor Beach in the flooded marsh where the sand and tide occasionally shift, exposing grasping ribs of long-sunk ships, the ghost of days when deeper bottom made this harbor good. Docks bottom up, peppered among the seagulls. Thin light seeps in at noon's low angle here in last century's new church. Attenuated shadows reach the far wall where I sit carding the wool of my present discontent, my marriage freezing on its knees for Lent, hoping for a thread while this gloriously well-intended preacher drones about transformations of the past, the taking of midwinter for Christ's birth by omnivorous promoters who uprooted, then offered solace to those severed from the earth, whispering paternal advice eternally in the ear, your personal stereo antidote to fear. In the marshes, the tide blankets all which has been diverse into a homogeneous weave. Underneath, pagan crabs still prey on lesser creatures. Bacteria decompose, seagrass roots, shameless organisms of all sorts cavort to propagate, going forth to feed the fish. In two moon times, even marshland will be solid, the end of days foreshadowed in the death of motion. In the granite quarries, swollen against bedrock walls, the ice will crack like thunder. I kind of like that one. Oh, another minister poem. I'm so sorry, Gail. In which I dropped the F-bomb. But, you know, it's this precedence right here. Okay. Thrall, which is what we're all going to be in a couple of years. Thrall. Indroit. O ground, O root, O core, O limb, O wave, O wind, O fire, O mist, O mystery. Call. I'm going to start this over because I forgot to say a couple of things. And that's a short part. Call is the call to ministry. When some people have heard this, they don't know what Pimp My Ride is because they're not cool. And my kids said it. So Pimp My Ride means that you decorate your car all up, and you know, so it makes it into a pimpmobile. And the rest is fairly self-explanatory, sort of. Okay. Thrall, introit, O ground, O root, O core, O limb, O wave, O wind, O fire, O mist, O mystery. Call. O pimp my ride, O God, of all the little silver vehicles, so I can find mine in this lot at Salem State where you have called me today. O pimp my mind, O God, of all the little silver neurons, so I can find my path, a logical way to live as you have called me to serve. No giggling. Oh, find my route, O God, on this crooked road. Show me the wave, the photon, the particle, whatever, whatever it takes, O God, or I am so screwed. Oh, fuck me, O God, for you have my will, and I surely my core is bound to follow whatever path, O God. I am in a mist, O God, salt air, salt tears, salty tongue. Send me through the refiner's fire. Let me melt, O God, melt away. Oh, pimp my ride, pimp me. The mystery is yours, the plight is mine. I fly to you, to you, to you. Oh, please, O God, to you. All right. You know how many people have written poems about Cape Ann? Staggering. I have one of Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Ann Sexton and all kinds of people. Crazy. Hyperspace. Oh, I have two kids. Hyperspace. The drive from Pittsfield to Bangor takes 40 minutes on a good day. A bit far for a flick, but this one had been out since May and was all the buzz, at least for the sci-fi potboiler fans. So I strapped you in to the 1977 face-forward front seat child escape pod and off we went. Re-entry into Pittsfield was smooth, swooping in the newly christened Millennium Falcon Saab through the November snow, big wet flakes catching the headlight beam, swooping by the windshield, propelling you at 2.5 into your generation and hyperspace. The kid's an executive now. It's disgusting. All right. Grinding up. All right. Kid number two. Blood-ledge grout pile. Oh, yeah. Get your butterick out. Blood-ledge grout pile. The glacier bared bedrock receded. Slowly lichen, moss, wild weeds, trees collected an acrid soil. Stripped now. Quarried. Abandoned piles of scrap stone. Jumbled. Rumble-tumbled to rest. Keyed by gravity. By the speeding, resistant inner flux. While we sit atop the pile in lichen, moss, weeds, and pines. You, 10 months old, trying to fit the lid on your bottle. Scribble in my pocket spiral. I find the pine cone, the roots down between the stone. The sunlight down around, air freshening. Your tender feet off, offended by the rough ground. Still driven to try. You scramble around, finding so little that fits. Yet at home trying. I see molecules, math, mysterious patterns, growth through the immeasurable time, growth through immeasurable time, the assurances and doubts of physics, numbers, uncertainty principles I can't read but know are there. Of we two, who sees more? Oh, yeah, good. Less to go than I thought. And now my fond farewell. Plexiglass funeral. With apologies to Auden, Williams, Whitman, and Wordsworth, but not much. Fulspechalski is a perfectly respectable funeral parlor in the Common in Salem, Massachusetts. I can't help it if I think Full Monty every time I drive by. When I die, I want the full Spichalski. What I really want is the old pine box and a roast, but she wants to see my body, my last connection to the world, so I say fine. But none of this half-open, half-shut stuff. In fact, plexiglass, full view, open, nude. And dead, I won't look so great, so better use some spray paint. Bright blue all over would be a nice touch. And then for art's sake, true red in the afternoon, and yellow in the evening with a Grateful Dead play of lights. No green, just pure color like Mondrian. But without any black line fig leaf, no one will be impressed, even though I expect you to invite everyone, anyone who may have thought me cute. Please, though, hide my pinky toes so no one will see the deformity of the nails curled back on themselves in the blob. The scars on my shins where I always bump into things? Don't worry, the spray paint will cover them. The hand should be palm up to show the calluses and by any means possible, a silly grin. I wouldn't want you to kiss me goodbye without my war paint and a silly grin. Thank you. That was fun. Oh, I'm going to pedal that.
You're talking about multiplexers made me think about Simon Geller. And I wanted to, I know there's so many people in this room who are longtime Cape Ann residents. And I'm just curious for my own edification. Does everybody know about WVCA.com? Does anybody know about WVCA.com? Gregor does. So about a year ago, well, the story starts a little bit before that when I sort of took all of Simon Geller's audio tapes from Works Chevrolet, his last studio, and put them in my cellar for about 26 years. And then a few years ago, I met this guy in Ohio who was a fan of Simon's from Chelmsford. And he had a son in Lowell. And they were both audio engineers. So they got excited about creating a virtual WVCA, which has existed now for through the Writers Center's auspices for, what, Annie, about 9 months or so. So if you're interested in Simon Geller, if you just type in WVCA.com, there's 700 hours of digitized music that we did that are on, it's, that's on the web. So, so much for multiplexing. Sage came to Gloucester about 40 years ago. He lives adjacent to Ravenswood Park and above Freshwater Cove. And these are the place, these places supply the material for many of his poems. He practiced law here for about 10 years and then returned back to teaching. He occasionally teaches courses now in writing and in early literature at North Shore Community College. And he's been published in North Essex Review, Living Proof, Friends of Arcadia Journal, and Poet Paris, and the Almond Memories, and in Almond Memories, a chapbook. So, Sage.
Wow. A lot of folks out there. as Henry mentioned, he had tried to get us to write something about the election cycle for what, before we started out. And I had something all worked out. And then the election happened, and it doesn't work out anymore. So. okay, I'm going to start out with an oldie. Which most of you will recognize. It's called The Wake of the Schooner. For the last time, the old ship sets out. Teams in unison haul away the heavy, gaff-rigged mainsail till it's in position, taut and white against the blue sky. Next the foresail, throat and peak, then the jumbo and the jib. Gradually, silently, the great hull inches forward, gaining speed as the light air fills the sails. Hands go aloft, set the topsails, catch the freshening breeze. She heels slightly, leaving barely any wake at all, a thin, small ripple in the water behind her. Astern, the early morning sun creates millions of diamonds on the tiny wavelets of the harbor, framed by the wharves and the ice plants, the pastel houses, the spires and towers rising from the Gloucester shore. But now, as all sails catch the wind, she fairly flies, schooning over the waves, leaving a boiling, frothy, white foam, a living wake, extending as far back as man can remember. Once the schooner, built for speed and space, was the heart of the city, St. George's and Stillwagon Banks, the great fisheries of the North Atlantic, she raced to fill her holds with ice-down cod. They were longliners then, setting out in dories, plucked from the mothership and dropped into the endless ocean. Two men, a tub of trawl, hooks and bait and lines to set, long and far behind. Pull the trawl, dump the cod into the dory, now so full one man would bail while the other rowed. Back to the schooner and out again until the hold was crammed with fish, and then the race to port. Now, as the old schooner completes her last trip, heads into port, the roiling, rollicking wave subsides with the wind, becomes instead a long, thin line, threading its way through the oily scum, the wrack and detritus of the modern harbor, disappearing finally in the faraway chop of the waves, the sanctity of the sea. Okay, I'm going to stay with the sea for a while. This next one is a villanelle, which is a 19-line poem in the first and last lines of the first verse continue periodically through the poem. It's called Down to the Sea. And this I wrote shortly after The Perfect Storm. You may catch the reference. Excuse me. It hurts to leave your lover's tears, as fishermen must whenever they go to face the towering waves of the sea. In port, they drink in dark bars. Shots and beers help ease the trip. But again, it will hurt to leave behind their lover's tears. A week, maybe two, they'll live hard and free, love often, raise hell, spend all they can, wash out the towering waves of the sea. Always too soon, the next trip draws near. They fight each other with their fists and their words, not wanting to leave their lover's tears. They sail with the tide, with mercy, the weather will hold. This time they won't need to face the towering waves of the sea. Hard fishing, long hours keep the mind free, but at night as they sleep in their bunks, they dream about leaving their lovers in tears, plunge under the towering waves of the sea. That's in reference to one of the boats that was lost during the perfect storm. I seem to be fixated with water here. I got a few more of them.
Bathroom over there.
Okay. Moving waves. They never cease to intrigue, the waves, in all their different shapes and sounds and sizes. One could sit here on the beach, the granite jetty, the rocky shore, watching for hours as they approach, cresting, 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 and finally thundering onto the granite blocks, spume and water flying high above, misting all below. Or just rolling in gently, little fingerlings lapping the beach, then slowly, quietly gone. Much like ourselves, now peaceful and serene, moving towards an understanding which we may never attain, yet always cresting again, over and over. Often, though, we rise in anger, lash out at all that tries to block us, twisting and turning, striking out at everything, everyone, until the tide ebbs again and again. Staying in the same area. This is called Foghorn. Is there anywhere a sadder sound than the moaning of a foghorn? Not the mourning dove, whose coo contains the elusive notes of love, nor the loon, whose call borders always on the ragged edge of laughter. It's strange how you don't hear it until you listen, and then you're caught, drawn into that deep blue wail which you can't stop hearing, nor do you want to. There is magic in this lonesome, eerie note, as powerful as Muddy Waters or John Lee Hooker's blues, sending pain and longing deep into your soul. Okay, I'll stay with sound for a while. This is called the Hindu Jazz Quartet. I'm sorry. Sorry. This is the Hindu Jazz Quintet. Excuse me.
Oh.
It does make a difference, really. The dark room of a local jazz club. Music begins with a hum of bronze. Violin and alto sax play the same riff. Swoons of air. First one, then the other. Perhaps in unison, celebrations in low relief, their tones so similar, impossible to tell. Always the steady bass keeps the subtle beat, backed up by the Indian tabla, caressed by hand, and challenged by the Western drum set, forcing an entrance, catching the echoes and competing rhythms with drumsticks and brushes, rusty with worthy, more beautiful than symmetry. Slowly, inexorably, the tension builds, then drops, only to rise again, ending finally, not with a crescendo, but an ever softer return to the quiet beauty of the sax and strings, itself evanescent. The sound of the wind. The sound of the wind is an echo of my mind. It sings of sacred longings, of fears forgotten. Some mornings it wakens me with its loud and violent surges, reminders of a childhood dream. At midday, playing in an open field, the wind caresses, urges me to forget it all, lie here forever, no plans, no future, only the sun in the sky. On Aelis, sailing over the bay, the wind would tease and taunt, flapping the sails impatiently, until our course was steady, then blow us ever outward, beyond the final buoy to the open ocean. Sometimes the wind blows cold, biting through my clothing, whispering thoughts of death. Then, in the evening, it settles in upon itself and wraps the world again in quiet. We mentioned Ravenswood and my use of it in my poems. So here's a poem about Ravenswood mostly. It's called A Morning Walk. As I took my morning walk, Lucy kept slowing us down, stopping every couple of steps, carefully sniffing, cataloging who and what had been there the night before. At first I resisted, tugging at her leash, anxious to move on to discover the things I could detect. The onset of warmer weather, the deep blue sky, the croaking of the spring peepers, still hoarse as they emerge from their winter sleep. I wanted to hear the scolding of squirrels, the warnings of ravens. I wanted to see the female cardinal in her subdued but beautiful colors. Forgetting that this was Lucy's walk, her time to explore the multitude of odors and stories that I can never know. So I stopped pulling and let her walk as I walked mine. Okay, this is, well, it's in autumn, so this is called The Carnality of Autumn. Think of autumn's caramel apples, smooth and sweet and sticky, melting in your mouth and down your throat, a small implosion of pleasure. Or the color of tree leaves in mid to late fall, how they change from the placid green of summer to the blazing reds, brilliant yellows, even the duller browns, warm and soothing as they fall. The harsh honking of the geese, opposed by the steady peeps of the sanderlings, or the exultant murmuration of starlings, all eager to start their long journey south. And the very air we now breathe outside, the crisp sharpness of your first cold breath, pleasant acrid smell of burning leaves, the salty tang from the onshore breeze, all these blended together will hint perhaps at the heart of autumn, the regrets of summer gone, countered by the embrace of welcome change, of return to longer nights and warmer fires. Okay, I'm going to get out of Gloucester. I grew up in Maine, and I went up there 4 or 5 years ago. A friend of mine had a little cabin up there, and I rented it out for a week to try to do some poetry. And this is one of the poems that I got out of that trip. It's called O Maine. O Maine, it is so achingly beautiful, even now in the icy grip of winter. This morning, near Cape Rozier, a little cove, a Maine cove, surrounded by the omnipresent rocky coast and evergreens and the cove itself, sea smoke rising thick as summer fog, so cold I can feel it piercing through my mittens, my hat, my coat, even as I drive by. Occasionally the dense forest or open water gives way to vast blueberry barrens, burnt out red in their winter coat, stretching on and on, up rock-strewn hills and down, desolate and bare and beautiful. Later, in my cabin, in front of a hot wood stove, I gaze out the window at a river of sea ice, small patches of open water on either shore. On the far side, a rich dark green, changing to an expanse of bluish gray, punctuated with white upheavals wherever the ice has contracted or been pushed upwards. Here, the sail pattern of a small schooner, others, arp-like forms and snarls. There is no life on this ice, no clamor, only the peaceful cycle of the changing tide and the certainty of solitude. this is a childhood scene at home from my younger days at home. Called Another Dinner Party. Upstairs in my bedroom, I could hear the music playing, the murmuring chatter, the different laughs, hearty roars of rum or whiskey, cheerful giggles, ice in glasses. After the guests were gone, angry words, the bitter dry martini, emerged beside the ugly shouts of too much bourbon. Wide awake now, trying not to hear the liquor growing louder, harsher. Later in the kitchen, dishes rattled, glasses clinked, icy words grew heated, loud. Next, a sudden tinkle of shattering glass, then screaming, then nothing. Still at last, but still I listened, fearful of the sudden quiet, listened for that silvery tinkle, poised on the delicate rim of desire and despair. Okay, I'm going to try and make it through this one. Some of you have heard this before, but see if I can do it this time. This is my stepfather. I'm sorry, Jack. Sorry about many things, I guess, but mostly about our relationship with each other. It wasn't your fault that we were never close, that you were never allowed to be really my father. It was poison from the first. My mother, with her brilliant husband, promising writer, patriotic war hero, killed before I was two, never possible to be replaced, not by you, the new man in her life, even before she ceased grieving. Why so soon, I wonder? Love? A new father for her two young children? Someone to fill the empty space? She never really said it. she never really said it, but she always let us know that you could never take our father's place. You weren't smart enough. You weren't the right class. But mostly, I now think, your discharge for shell shock was not nearly serious enough to let you be my father. Certainly you tried. I remember the hunting and fishing trips we had together, the sailing adventures, the time we couldn't get back into the harbor and had to beach the boat and walk home, the time we tried to rescue my dog who had fallen through the fallen sea ice. You really were my father, but I never got it until I cried at your funeral. Thank you. Okay, and just another main one. You shouldn't go home again. Long after it was sold, I went back to Maine to see the family home again. I didn't go onto the property. It was, in any case, easier to see from the landing just across the little cove. The house itself, which had been a gray, flat roof, low-key Bauhaus design, sort of disappearing into the woods, was now a bright white colonial with shutters and a conventional pitched roof. Worse yet, the huge old pine tree, where I had climbed and dreamt of pirate ships and hidden treasures, the one which had stood in the L between the living and dining rooms, was gone. The wharf itself, constructed of massive granite blocks, now looked like a conventional marina, complete with docks and high-powered speedboats. And the field, between the wharf and the house, the beautiful rustic field, once populated by sumac and strewn with driftwood and granite boulders, was now an immaculate lawn, so flat and perfect it could have been a putting green. I'm sorry now that I came back to say goodbye. I wish I'd never come.